All right, take your Bibles and go with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, the second chapter of 1 Thessalonians. Last time we finished verse 4, speaks much about the gospel and how Paul was going to be entrusted with the gospel and how he was entrusted with the gospel and the responsibility that came along with that trust. Look at verse 4. We ended there, but we can just pick up the thought because he's really talking about winning others, having a burden for others and their need for salvation and their need for the gospel. Notice what it says. But as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak. And so Paul was proclaiming in those first four verses the importance of us telling the gospel, witnessing to others. Do we take advantage of that? Recently, I have been convicted in my own heart since our revival about my lack of doing it when I know that I should be doing more of it. And so I have tried since our revival, I have sought to specifically be sensitive to every opportunity to witness to others as I would have opportunity to come along and then go even out of my way to do so. It might be along my way through the day. It might be meeting someone along the way or seeing someone. But people are hurting. Not long ago, I was walking through the hospital and someone was just weeping in the waiting area. Those are great opportunities to introduce yourself and say, I notice that you're struggling. Is there anything that I can pray with you about? I noticed one day in a restaurant, the waitress flipped open her order pad, and there were pictures of children. I said, are those your children? And she said, yes. And I said, well, we're Christians, and do you have any specific needs about your children? And she began to cry as she told us some needs about her children. We had opportunity to witness, opportunity to give a track, opportunity to say, will you read this? Yesterday, Eric Miller gives tracks. He would give tracks to the statues down at the hospital if they'd take them. He gives track to everybody. And so it thrills my heart about that. Well, this week I read something that just pricked my heart concerning the gospel. And I want to read it to you as I found it because it's very convicting. In a small church on the East Coast, a pastor delivered a stirring sermon on salvation and soul winning. After the service, one of the members, a German man who migrated to the U.S. after World War II, told of his experience. And here's the experience that he tells. My family and I were reached with the gospel in Germany during the Nazi Holocaust. We heard stories of what was happening to the Jews, but we tried to distance ourselves from it because what could any of us do to stop it? A railroad track ran behind our small church, and each Sunday morning we could hear the whistle in the distance and then the wheels coming over the tracks. We became disturbed when we heard the cries coming from the train as it passed. We realized that it was crying Jews as they were carried away like cattle in the railroad cars. Week after week, the whistle would blow. We dreaded to hear the sound of those wheels because we knew that we would hear the cries of the Jews en route to the death camp. Their screams tormented us. We knew the time the train came past our church, and when we heard the whistle blow, we began singing hymns. By the time the train came past our church, we were singing at the top of our voices. If we heard the screams, we sang more loudly, and soon we heard them no more. Pastor, years have passed, and our family doesn't talk about it anymore. But I still hear that train whistle in my sleep. God, forgive me. God, forgive all of us who called ourselves Christians then, and yet did nothing. Now the pastor pins after that story, he pins this. There are people all around us in a similar situation as those Jews in train cars. But their destination is a worse destination. They are on their way to hell. Are we like those German Christians? Do we ignore the problem? Or do we want to do something about it? There should be no question as to what we should do, the pastor says. We have the one thing that is able to save them from this destruction, the gospel. Paul was entrusted with the gospel. You and I are entrusted with the gospel. Too many times in the Bible do we find the urgency of finding those that's unsaved and bringing them to Christ. It is the sob of God Himself in Psalm 126. It is the anguished cry of Christ as He wept over a doomed city, looking out and seeing Jerusalem. It was the plea of Paul as he said, I wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. It was the prayer of John Knox as we read church history. Lord, give me Scotland, else I die. It was the declaration of John Wesley when he proclaimed, the world is my parish. And it is seen in the fear of parents who are burdened for their children, grandparents for their grandchildren, family members for aunts and uncles and moms and dads. Paul was driven by being entrusted with the gospel. But he took it one step further, beginning in verse 5 through verses 8. We see his motivation. What was the driving factors behind being entrusted with the gospel? In other words, I'm entrusted with the gospel. I'm going to be winning. Now, what am I going to do with those I win? I want to see people saved, Paul was saying. Been entrusted with the gospel. Now, what will we do with them after they are saved? And how will they know that we're sincerely in love with them and to help them and to nurture them along? In other words, it's just getting saved is just one third of the Great Commission. There's baptism, and then there is maturity, being taught the things of Christ. And the Apostle Paul knew that. And we begin in the second paragraph of this chapter. We begin with the thought of the drivers behind the Apostle Paul after he committed himself to the gospel. How he wanted to be perceived in his ministry by those that he had the privilege of winning and ministering to. He realized that people judge us by our outward conduct. That's all we have for each other. We do not see the heart. God sees the heart. We do not see the heart. Now, when the heart is changed and the outward is changed, then people can see what has happened inward by how we act outwardly. So it's important that we understand that being saved just doesn't give us some fire insurance from hell. And then we go on living the way we want to. Being saved brings us to an obligation to grow in God's grace and mature in Him, grow up in Him, that we will be fitly joined together as believers in the local church, that we might walk with Him as we learned months ago on Wednesday nights as we walked in the Spirit. And so Paul begins by saying, I know first and foremost that God is my witness of every motive. It's behind everything I do and say. Look at verse 5, and we see that so clearly. Matter of fact, let's read the text, verses 5 through 8, and then we're going to take these verses apart and look at them this evening. For neither at any time used we flattering words, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness. He brought God in as his witness about his motivation for ministry. And that's the title of this message, Paul's Motivation for Ministry. Now that he has been ministering the gospel and people's being saved, what about his motive where he's going to carry him from their salvation through the waters of baptism and on into to maturity? Look at verse 6. Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, when you might have been, when we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because ye were dear unto us. When I read that passage of Scripture and began preparation in this series, this verse-by-verse series, I realized that Paul wanted God to be his witness about his motive for ministry. Why is he doing what he is doing in the church? Now, I want you to understand that that same question should come to you. This is just not a pastoral thing. This is everyone in the church. Why do we do what we do? What is the motive behind it? It's interesting. This word witness is the same word witness in Acts chapter 1, verse 8. And ye shall be witnesses unto me. And that word is translated in the Greek language using the word martus, which we get our word martyr from. So to become a witness in the first century church often meant that there would be persecution, and we've already learned that from chapter 1. Anguish, martyrdom, we learned that from Acts chapter 7. As Stephen was stoned, being the first martyr. So we know that there was heavy persecution. And oftentimes, if we're not careful, what happens is we forget that God witnesses our motive and we become very proud at who we are. And all of a sudden we think that God is so blessed to have us. People are so honored to know us. And our motive begins to change. And pride comes into our life. I was speaking to someone about this just this week. When you really look at sins that have a long-term effect on people in the second generation or the people right behind those who are leaders, you find that pride devastates generations. Did you know that there is more sharpness in the Bible about the sin of pride than the sin of whoredom? Because of its effects on others. Ironside said this: it is quite possible to be an admired teacher upon whose words thousands hang, or an eloquent evangelist with eager multitudes flocking to listen with delight to his messages, and yet be a vain self-seeker, using the very gift that God has given for personal gain, even while professing to care little or nothing for money or wealth. But the more marked the pastoral gift of a very necessity, the more unselfish, devoted one must look in his own heart. In other words, what he is saying is if we do not look in our own heart, selfish motives takes over. And all of a sudden, ambition moves itself way above God's call. And all of a sudden, we think we have handles on situations and truths that by our own pride is going to fall and cause a fall if we're not careful. Now, there are just two things I want us to see in this passage. Number one, I want us to see things that are negative, first of all, that Paul deals with, what things are not supposed to be like, and then the positive. So let's look at it quickly this evening. Back in verse 5, the negative. Notice that Paul did not win them by flattery. We, speaking of his colleagues, we didn't come to you with flattering words. This is more than just trying to woo someone. This is flattering words is to build them up, build yourself up, not pondering what's really the truth, but pondering what you want people to know about you. This passage of Scripture removes every element of self when it comes to service. It pulls away every single element. And flattering words are words that build up others for the sake of controlling those people, for the sake of having an inroad, or for the sake of deceiving them. Got to remember, he warned in the previous chapter about false teachers who will come in and be very persuasive, especially during times of tribulation and pressure. Paul did not win them by using flattery. He did not win them by using his position. We did not come, notice what it says in verse 5, we did not come to you with a cloak of covetousness. He did not have a mask motive. That's what they knew. When he said these words, they understood him. They understood this phrase. He did not act on behalf of their spiritual good. He acted way beyond that. His concern was genuine. He said on one occasion, I have coveted no man's silver, gold, or apparel. There's no cloak of covetousness with me. But there are false prophets. Peter warned this. There's false prophets among you, even as there shall be false teachers among you who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that brought them, and bringing unto themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. Think about that just for a moment. A cloak of covetousness. Peter ends verse 3 by saying, covetousness and feigned words make merchandise of others. Paul was saying, I didn't come to make merchandise of you. I did not come to exploit you. And true preachers of the gospel must be free from the dangerous vice of having a cloak of self-righteousness or a motive, a mask motive of why they would do what they would do. And a true servant leader in the church would not have a mask motive of why they would have set out with their agenda. They must be willing to remove that. Look at verse 6, and he talks about how he hated vainglory. Notice what it says in verse 6. Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others. Matter of fact, it bothered him. He did not want to receive glory. The phrase, nor sought of men we glory, simply refers to, we did not seek to impress you in order to extract glory for ourselves. That's not why we came to you. We did not come to make you think more highly of us, or to puff us up. We didn't come for that type of glory. We didn't come, neither did we come to the new converts of you, some of you who were one. And you know, new converts, think about this. New converts are very impressionable, are they not? Very impressionable. He says, even when people were one, we were not trying to exploit them in any fashion whatsoever. We did not have an agenda. We were entrusted with the gospel. We saw them saved. And now our motive is to see them grow. And we want you to see that we're not hypocritical about that. And Paul was a very transparent preacher. Notice the phrase also in verse 6, nor yet of others. Other believers. among their missionary travels. He said, check our record. You'll be able to see. We did not seek to serve to get some kind of glory. The spirit in the church at Thessalonica was a wonderful spirit because the leadership and the mission team that was there were not seeking glory for themselves or an agenda for themselves. They were not lording over God's heritage. That's not the purpose of them coming. And they did not want to be a personal burden on anyone. Look at verse 6 and how it concludes. When we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ. He immediately says, we are apostles of Christ. We're not apostles of ourselves. We didn't come here to be a burden to you. We didn't come here to be weighty. The word burdensome has to do with weights. We did not come here to weigh you down. Now, this word weight is also used in the Bible when it speaks about Paul's preaching doctrine and how weighty it was. That was good weight. Preaching doctrine sometimes puts pressure on you, does it not? Puts pressure on me. Because all of a sudden now a truth is being introduced that brings conviction to us. So that kind of weight is good for us. But he used this same word burden, burdensome. We do not want to personally put weight upon you. That's not why we came. We did not want to be a burden. We were apostles of Christ. If you're an apostle of self, you can have ulterior motives. We have a lot of that in ministry today, do we not? We would call them charlatans. You have to be careful. Not every preacher that stands in front of the TV camera and opens his Bible is going to tell you the truth. He's not going to be there to preach the word to you. I'm amazed at how many preachers, their entire ministry, every time I've ever even just been flipping through the stations and just stayed on one person 3 minutes, it's always about money. It's always about you planting a seed in this ministry so God will bless you. Don't be so foolish as to believe that. You have a local church that's taking care of your spiritual needs. The TV preacher is not going to come and deal with you at the hospital and stay up with you all night, meet you at the funeral home or your family at the funeral home. Won't do that. But a pastor who cares, who realizes that he is an apostle of Christ, not of himself. His calling wasn't of himself. His calling was from the Lord. And he was entrusted with the gospel. So he brings out the negative in the first part of this text. But notice, if you would with me, the positive in verses 7 and 8. Paul's ministry is marked with a wonderful word. Gentle. Now, I think sometimes we as fundamentalists, we lose our gentleness. I have met some fundamentalists, they're just downright mean-spirited. They're angry at something. Even their anger is wrong. Now, we can be angry and sin not. But the word gentle, it's a great word. It refers to the conduct of proper leadership. Paul was the pastor. He was the church planter. And just as a superior to an inferior worker is gentle, it should be that way. We should not be hard taskmasters. A master toward his servant, one who appreciates his servant, not one who is browbeating his servant. Now, I'm not saying there cannot be accountability. There should be. Gentleness never overlooks accountability. But even when accountability has to be addressed, it should be addressed in a right disposition. Like a prince toward his subjects, a father toward his son, mother toward her child, which we're going to look at in just a moment, a husband toward his wife. These are all word pictures in the New Testament that appear to us and prove out this word gentle. And the servant of the Lord, Timothy said, or Paul said to young Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle. Gentle unto all men, not gentle unto your pets. Not gentle unto those in whom you like more than others. But all men, gentle unto all men. In other words, no one is treated politically. No one gets more attention than someone else. Everyone is just as important. Even Galatians 5, Paul speaks about the fruit of the Spirit being gentle. There is a gentleness in that fruit. James also speaks about this truth. But the wisdom that is from above is pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easily entreated. It's a great verse, isn't it? So he was gentle. Now, notice the word picture in which he uses here. Go back to verse 7, if you would. And notice what he says. We are gentle among you, even as a nurse. Now he gives a word picture. Now he gives an illustration of this gentleness. Even as a nurse, it says. That's referring to a nursing mother. A mother who is going to take care of her child. The word cheriseth means to foster tender care. Do you know how, and I found in the book of Deuteronomy a word picture of how birds show how they cherish each other. A mother bird would cherish her young, in the, especially when there needs to be some needs taken care of in the, of the little ones. Even when they needed fanning or cooling off, she would flap her wings to cool her young down. And that is what cherish does. A mother is always cherishing her young. Just nursing them along. You see, a mother that knows how to cherish her children is a mother who is not satisfied with just nursing her child. She is affectionately interested in every aspect of that child's life. And that's what Paul says about him ministering to others. I'm not here to mark time. I'm not here for vainglory. I'm not here to make a name for myself. I'm not here to be a burden on you. He says, I am here to nurse you along, to cherish that nursing. I'm not just interested in you being saved. I'm very grateful for that. But what about the daily needs of your life? That's what he was saying to these people. What about your life when needs come up? Paul says, I want to be able to be there for you for those needs. You can depend upon me. It's just not about you coming and giving your money. It's not about you coming and serving and leaving and thinking that you never have a need. All of us have needs. We all need ministering to. None of us are without it. So Paul makes it clear how that should be done. And this is just not about a pastor who's nursing along his church. This is about how you and I should treat each other. There's latitude here. And Paul's ministry to others was with sincere personal love. And he was not shy about saying it. He was not shy about telling them that he loved them affectionately. Matter of fact, notice what it says in verse 8, affectionately desirous. He found his desire. That word desire has to do with being overcome with a lust in a good way. I have a desire to show my affection. I'm desirous of that. It's not something I have to muster up. It's not something I have to roll my eyes about and say, oh, I got to be nice to this guy. No, it's consistent. It changes the heart of anyone who would be ministering to others. But we are quick to be roughshod. We're quick to think that people ought to be beyond their need. We move out so quickly and so fast. It reminds us that he was no more afraid to preach the truth about the gospel than he was on the flip side of that to say, I care for you. He was able to do that. He shows that in verse 8. Notice the word willing. It's a great word. Look at verse 8. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only. We're grateful. We were entrusted with the gospel of God. That's verse 4. We're going to take it a step further than that. We have a desire. We have a lust within us, a good lust within us, a desire to show that we have an affection for you and your needs. So we didn't come to you to burden you down and for you to put a feather in our cap and for vainglory. We came to minister. And it pleased us to do so. And that's the word willing. The word willing carries the idea. It pleased. We were pleased to do so. We were happy to do it. You see, he not only preached the unadulterated truth, but he predetermined to be a sacrifice to those people. Notice what he says in verse 8, the B part of the verse. We were willing to have imparted unto you not only the gospel of God, but also our own souls. Now, I've mentioned this before, but I want to mention it now because it's a good proof text. Sometimes the word soul in the Bible has to do with the living soul that will be with the Lord one day. But sometimes the word soul refers to our life. And that's the case here. This word soul means that we gave our lives for this. We lived for this. We were desirous to love you. We didn't have to muster it up. We care. We didn't come to be a burden. We came to be a blessing and a help. That's what he was saying. So he predetermined that he was going to live out his leadership that way. And then he, lastly, look at verse 8. Ye were dear to us. He proclaimed his love. He preached the unadulterated gospel. He predetermined to be a sacrifice. And did he not prove to us through his New Testament writings that he was willing to sacrifice right to his very life? Yes, he did. Incredible example. And now he's proclaiming that desirous affection that he had. He was so desirous to show them. Now, let me address something that I think is key. Just as everyone's needs to be met. Now, please listen, okay? Every one of us needs to be loved, too. Should be taken for granted. But saying it, showing it, and sharing it is imperative. How unwise it would be for any husband to tell his wife on the day they got married, I love you, and expect that to last for the next 35, 40, 50 years. It doesn't happen that way, does it? So what happens all along that relationship? We show it. We say it. In other words, we're busy about it. And all of us have needs. And all of us needs to be loved. Do not think that you're above being loved by others in this church. When you learn that love of the brethren is a part of the New Testament church, you will share it, you will show it, you will say it. You'll not mind it at all. And it will come natural. You won't have to muster it up. It'll come natural. and showing and saying appreciation, I very seldom ever end a phone conversation or a personal conversation or an email by saying thank you to people who serve, who give of themselves, who are willing to give of their very lives, their time, their efforts, their gifts, their resources. These are huge contributions. And then to think for a moment, how presumptuous would it be to think for a moment if any of us get so full of ourselves that we feel like that we are owed anything? May the Lord help us to have a proper motive for ministry. And this paragraph teaches that. We didn't come to you for vainglory. We didn't come to you being a burden. We didn't come to you with all these words of flattery. We came with a sincere desire to affectionately love you. And we preached the gospel unto you, but after that we didn't leave you alone. We just kept loving you. And every time we have opportunity to love someone, we ought to take that opportunity to show it, to say it. And when we do, it will be a great encouragement to others that someone cared. So what is our motive? Is our motive self-gain and recognition, glory for ourselves? We're going to serve in the office of a church. This next year, we're getting ready to have our annual business meeting. We're going to serve in an office so that we can be known of others how great a Christian we are here at Cross Point. We should all humble ourselves and realize we don't deserve any of that. It's only by God's grace and through the gospel of that we know that became a reality in our own lives one day that gives us the privilege to serve. And when we have opportunity to say thank you, when we have opportunity to show appreciation and affection, we should take advantage of it. You say, well, you know, I'm just a little roughshod. I'm just built a little bit different than that. Well, God can help you with that. He's helped you with other things. You say, well, I'm not a mushy person. Didn't ask you to be mushy, just asked you to be sincere. See, we want to turn it into something it's not. It's just simply these words. And our motive for ministry is so vitally important. I want my motive to be pure. I don't want it to be driven by self-gain. I want it to be pure. I want to have a sincere love about me. I don't want to be superficial. And neither should you. And it's good to say it from time to time and to show it. And by doing that, we all become part of a family that would be knit even closer together. And that's what a church family is all about, is showing love and care. You see, that's why it's important for us to realize to be a part of a ministry as a layperson or part of a faculty or a staff, to be a part of that is privilege. And it cannot be just duty and just a job. It can't be that way. It has to be heart. It has to be a calling. And when it is, we don't mind speaking to one another. We don't mind loving one another. We don't mind hanging around each other. Are you understand what I'm saying? We don't mind being with each other. We take advantage of fellowship. We take advantage of loving one another. Take advantage of being faithful to your local church. When you show that, you show how mature you are. But when we do not love and when we are not faithful, we show that our heart has a glitch. something's not right. And that's when we need to make an examination and say, are we really giving ourselves to ministry? If we are, then let's be desirous of affection one toward another and have a right motive in ministry. Would you stand with me, please?